Hi, Richard Feidler here. Thanks for downloading this Conversations podcast. There are many, many more at abc.net.au/conversations.
Conversations with Richard Feidler on ABC Local Radio.
Hello and welcome to Conversations. If you ever had piano lessons as a kid, maybe there was a time when you asked yourself, what can I really know of the great artist who wrote this music? Mozart, Chopin, Shostakovich, all had rich lives that were full of triumph and pain and madness and alienation, and you can hear it in their music. So when you're a 9-year-old kid whose feet can barely reach the pedals, how are you all going to find that in the music and yourself? Anna Goldsworthy is here. Anna is a classical pianist who's performed all over the world, and she's a writer too, which is no surprise since her dad is the novelist Peter Goldsworthy. When Anna was a little girl, her dad would accompany her several times a week to the house of a remarkable woman, a Russian piano teacher called Mrs. Sivan. Anna's written a really lovely memoir about her education with Mrs. Sivan, and now the memoir's been made into a stage production as part of the Queensland Music Festival. It's called Piano Lessons. Hello, Anna. Welcome to Conversations.
Hi, Richard. Thank you.
All three. You've got the book and the CD of the music that comes with it, and now a stage production. What's next, a theme park or what?
You may be right. My publisher did suggest that perhaps I should think about action figures. What else is next? I don't know if there's much more that I can milk out of this book, but there's a film in development. Well, a film script in development.
A film in development. Film script in development.
Yeah.
So that's just going from one thing to the next. It's amazing.
It is. Yeah.
On the cover of the CD, there's a picture of a little girl with a sort of a homemade stripy jumper on, carrying a kind of Globite case. Is that you, is it?
That's me in my grandma special rainbow jumper.
And you're beaming, you're smiling, you look like a happy girl. Were you a happy, lucky girl or a nervy, shy sort of little girl?
More of a nervy, shy little girl, I think. Perhaps that photo was deceptive. It captured me in an uncharacteristically joyful moment. I was a little bit... I actually was pathologically shy as a child. I remember my cousin giving me lessons in how to address an adult and saying I had to look them in the eye and say hello. And somehow that seemed like a physical impossibility.
Really?
Yeah.
You were speaking to your parents all the time, but was it the stranger?
It was the stranger, and most everybody who wasn't in the family was a stranger. I mean, at the risk of sounding, you know, entirely autistic, when I first started school, I used to spend every lunch hour just swirling around a pole outside the classroom, and my prep teacher used to drag me down to the playground, and I'd scream, hoping that I'd play with the other students, but then I'd just run up to my little pole again and just rotate around it for hours every day. I guess that's what I was doing.
Living in your own inner world.
Perhaps.
Where did your musical ambitions start?
They started with a passionate attachment to Young Talent Time. Desperately wanted to be in the Young Talent team.
Do you owe your musical career to...
Johnny Young.
Johnny Young and Tiny maybe Danny
Tina.
Minogue?
I think it was maybe pre-Danny. It was right. Tiny Tina.
Jane Scarley.
Yes.
All those Karen Knowles,
they're the ones. That's the period, that golden age of Young Talent Time.
I didn't see too many classical pianists on Young Talent Time.
No. Well, I actually had aspirations to be a singer, which my parents always gently discouraged because I have no voice. And I was sort of, and I thought perhaps learning piano would be a good stepping stone to getting there.
A stepping stone to Young Talent Time.
Yeah.
How big was classical music in your family?
It was pretty big. My grandparents were really keen amateur pianists. My parents both used to have a bit of a go. My uncle was a very good pianist. And sometimes at my grandfather's house, at my grandparents' house, on Sunday afternoon after a Sunday family lunch, my grandpa and my dad and my uncle would sit down and they'd have this sort of play-off in which my dad would trot out the one piece of classical music he knew, which was a Chopin waltz, I think, and then my uncle and my grandpa would sort of trump this with more complicated pieces. So it was just sort of part of the oral sort of soundscape, I guess, of growing up for me.
How intense would the rivalry between your dad and your grandfather get?
Between my dad and my uncle, particularly, that was quite an intense rivalry, and would often end up with one of them wrestling the other one to the ground and making them kiss the carpet. Still going on, I think.
What, leap from the stool, yeah, tackle the guy, yeah, and bring him down?
Kiss the carpet.
Kiss the carpet. Mm. That's the way you teach people to harden up in classical music.
Yeah.
When did you start? How young were you when you started piano?
I used to just sort of toy around with the instrument, but I started getting semi-formal lessons when I was about 6 with a local jazz teacher who was really easygoing. And then when I was 9, my grandpa discovered this astonishing teacher, Mrs. Sivan, and told Dad that I had to go and start learning from her.
How did he find Mrs. Sivan?
He was, at that stage, a regional director of the education department, and she'd just recently arrived in Adelaide. Actually, by accident, they'd been planning to go, I think, to Melbourne. But they'd wound up in Adelaide, and she'd got a job at a high school, Woodville High School. And Grandpa was just doing the rounds, doing an inspection, and just sort of chanced upon one of her lessons. And according to her, went up to her and said, "You will teach my granddaughter." So she didn't have a choice.
Right, he ordered her.
He ordered her to
teach you.
Yeah.
What was her story? How did she come to be in Adelaide from Russia?
Well, they'd left Russia in the late 70s, and they'd spent a few years floating around Europe.
Were they Jewish
yes.
migrants?
Yeah, they were. Her husband.
Because there was an exodus of Jewish people from the Soviet Union in the
it certainly enabled them to leave quite easily, I think. The fact that they were Jewish. And they spent a little bit of time in Israel, a lot of time around Europe. And then they were sort of thinking of going to the United States, but some terrible accident befell the son of one of their friends there, so they decided to come to Australia instead.
Where no accidents ever happen.
Nope, the safest place in the world, that's right. So they arrived in Sydney Airport, and they were sitting there waiting for their connection to Melbourne. And then their son Dimitri heard their names being called over some sort of, I suppose, the intercom. And they got on this plane to Adelaide. And I suppose this happened because there was a vacancy at the Pennington Migrant Hostel in Adelaide. But Eleonora said, well, I call her Eleonora now, Mrs. Sivan said, I'd never even heard this word, Adelaide. You know, she had no idea about what this place was. And they turned up in Adelaide on one of those awful Adelaide summer days, which you'd know about, Richard, being in Adelaide.
41 degrees, where you can be outside for about 10 minutes tops.
That's the one. Yeah,
and the footpath burns through the soles of your shoes. And
exactly,
your thongs.
Melts the rubber. Uh-huh. And she said she just arrived at the hostel and lay down in her bed and thought, "It's the end of my life. This is it. this is you know, hell." But Isaac, her husband, is actually quite resourceful, and somehow he was able to get on a bus and go on this sort of reconnaissance mission to the city centre, to Rundle Mall, and he surveyed the city and he came back later that night, and she told me that he said to her, I have good news. I have very good news. Adelaide is not just a little village, but it's a decent, medium-sized town. And he said, and definitely we can make a life here. And, you know, they did. They made a life there, and I think it's so impressive. We just celebrated her 30th year in Adelaide with a big concert at Elder Hall a fortnight ago, and I just think it's tremendous what the two of them were able to build over 3 decades.
Your whole life and career, then, hangs on that intercom message in the airport.
Oh,
you ever think
utterly.
About that?
Oh, I do all the time, I think, because I would not be a musician if it wasn't for her.
Tell me about the trip out to her place and meeting her for the first time, the impression she made on your 9-year-old self, Anna.
Overwhelming, utterly overwhelming.
Why?
Several reasons. She was a recent arrival. Her English wasn't great then. Her language is beautiful. It's so full of analogy and poetry and these kind of slightly crazed sort of connections. But at the time, she didn't have a huge vocabulary. And I think it was maybe the first time I'd come across somebody who had a strong accent. So to start with, I was struggling to understand what she was saying on a very basic level. But then beyond that, she was speaking in a sort of artistic musical vocabulary that was like nothing else I'd ever encountered. For her, music is not just a nice thing to do. It's not a hobby. It's utterly a vocation. It's utterly a way of life. And she approaches it with this sense of urgency, of sort of artistic urgency and passion. And, you know, from the moment she opened the door, she didn't stop talking. And how many years ago was that?
Despite her lack of English, she still wanted to talk and communicate.
Still talked continuously. And I think, I suppose it's 28 years ago now. In the 28 years since I met her, she hasn't stopped talking. That conversation's been going. But, and, you know, my very first lessons would go for much longer than any lesson I'd had before. And they'd just be this sort of torrent of words and ideas and demands.
How would she speak? Can you try and recreate her speech? How would she say it speak to you?
No, I can't do it.
Well, I'm not asking you for a kind of a impersonation. But
Let me think. Okay, so what would she say the very first time I arrived? I think she said something to me like, why are we so passionate about this instrument? Why are we so passionate about this? No, I give my students... let me think. She sort of speaks with a lot of rhetorical questions that at first I sort of felt compelled to answer, but then I realised they're not actually requiring a response.
An answer. Were you a child prodigy at 9?
You know, I think I like to believe I was, but I don't think I actually was.
You weren't one of those freakishly gifted kids who just absorb it like...
No, I wasn't. I really wasn't. I actually think I perhaps had more natural aptitude for other areas.
Why did she take you on? Why do you think she took you on as a student?
She claimed that she took pity on me. I think she felt she had no option because my grandfather, as she said, had a real natural authority.
Why did she take pity on you?
Oh, she said, 9-year-old girl who tries so hard and doesn't know a thing. Of course, she must be allowed to learn.
That's lovely. That's so nice.
And I think she recognised some sort of seriousness in me. And she, you know, she always gave me a lot of credit as a child for being intelligent and mature. But on the other hand, she said the sort of raw material she'd been working with in Russia, training people for competitions, were these sort of tremendously extroverted people to start with. And secondly, young musicians with what she called animal abilities, the ability to just sit down and perform a symphony after hearing it once, this type of thing. Well, that sort of achievement was well beyond me.
She was on the list. What was the list?
Well, the list is this type of musical pedigree that, in actual fact, a huge number of pianists all around the world can lay claim to. But in her case, what it meant was that the great pianist Liszt taught another famous pianist and pedagogue, a fellow called Leschetizky, who married one of his students called Esipov, Annette Esipov, and Esipov was actually the teacher of Mrs. Ivan's teacher.
And she's taught you, so you're on the list now.
Well,
I am
on the list now, yeah, along with, you know, every other man and his dog in the classical piano world.
Classical pianist and member of the list, Anna Goldsworthy is my guest in conversation. Anna is also an accomplished writer, and her memoir is, perhaps not surprisingly, called Piano Lessons, as is the CD, which is of her music, and the stage production, which is about to become part of the Queensland Music Festival. Have you got a picture in your head of that room?
Yes.
She taught you in?
Oh, yes.
Paint a picture of this fabulous Russian emigres.
Yeah, room. Well, the room actually evolved over the years. When I first went to her, she'd only just moved into this house, and its interior decoration didn't necessarily reflect her tastes. But it was part of, I think, the kind of overall sensory experience that overwhelmed me. There was a tiny little battered upright piano. She only got a grand piano a couple of years later with the help of some students. And it was pushed up against this wall that was painted this kind of iridescent metallic pink. And I just sort of remember feeling, you know, I arrived there and I was thinking, oh, goodness, you're in this sort of foreign environment and you're sort of searching for something that you can recognise, that you can kind of connect to. And there was this little calendar just pinned up against the piano, and I kind of stared at that and took comfort from that when there was this barrage of words coming at me.
I love the fact that she had lessons for you, but before your fingers even hit the keys. What did she tell you before you even began?
Well, I think perhaps at my very first lesson, I sat down to play some Bach and I got ready to play, and she yelled, "Stop!" And I said, "But I haven't even started yet." And she said, "Of course you've started. Your hands are wrong, your elbows are wrong." But the most important lesson she would talk about in that sense was that music begins before you begin.
How?
You have to have it in your ears and your imagination already. And I suppose you have to have an almost aural image of the sound you're trying to create. And over the years, I think I came to understand that better. I think it's perhaps if you're an artist, say, or if you wanted to draw a picture of something, if you wanted to draw a picture of a horse, you wouldn't just pick up your pencil and start moving it. You'd actually have to
visualize it
in your head to start with.
So what is that in your head that you're putting together? Are you able to describe? I know that sort of thing isn't easy to describe, but what is this that's assembled in your head then now before you play?
Before you play? A few things, I think. I think you need to have a concept of the piece in its entirety, a sort of overall picture of its structure. Mozart used to claim that he could experience a symphony in a second, in a single moment, which I think is an astonishing level of mastery. But it's that type of bird's eye view of the peaks and the troughs and where the piece is going. So you want to have that.
Are there pictures or colours?
Some, for some people there are colours. some composers particularly have had this condition called synesthesia, in which they have very specific visual analogies to the sounds that they're hearing.
I've always wanted to interview a synesthetic on this program. Always.
Yes.
Maybe you can introduce me afterwards to people
who are.
I'll look
out for one.
That would
yeah.
be great. So you have all that, this thing assembled in your head.
So you have the overall picture assembled in your head, but then I think to get into it, I suppose you want to have an emotional condition. You want to have a sound, really, a specific sound. And I suppose on some physical level, you need to have some kind of bodily awareness of what you have to do to create that specific sound. So, for instance, if I were starting with Bach, I'd probably have a sense of, you know, preparing my fingertips to really sink to the bottom of the keys. Or if I were about to begin a Chopin nocturne, I'd have a different physical approach, which would be a little bit more melted down.
I want to play a track of you playing one of the first things you learnt, which is a Bach minuet, which is from the Anna Magdalena notebook, which is just lovely. It's the second one. It's just nice, short, simple. It's only a minute, 20 seconds. It's just a really lovely, elegant piece. This is Anna Goldsworthy. That's Anna Goldsworthy performing a beautiful minuet by Bach there on her CD Piano Lessons, which has spun off the book Piano Lessons, which has become a stage play called Piano Lessons and maybe even a movie sometime soon. Anna, that's lovely hearing that. What did your teacher, Mr. Sivan, tell you about Bach?
Well, in our very first lessons, we came back to the... And I'd already studied these pieces with my previous teacher. And I remember foolishly saying to her, oh, I've done those, I've finished those. And one of the first important lessons she imparted to me about this was that, no, you haven't, you know. Bach is never finished. And how true that is. Like, you know, you come back to these pieces year after year after year and you find something new in them all the time. She said that Bach himself, well, she claimed that Bach himself said that creating music is easy. You just have to put the right note in the right place, which sounds deceptively simple, but there's an awful amount of art that goes into creating that impression of simplicity. For her, the philosophical message of Bach is one of peace. And it's a particular type of piece, and I think I understand this better now, it's a particular type of piece that has to do with continuity. In our early lessons, she'd continually sort of haul me over the coals for what she called sitting, for sort of inking a phrase with this kind of full stop and letting the music just kind of sit. Whereas in Bach, she believes every ending is also a beginning. And I think this is also the source of part of its philosophical message, which is a message of a type of serenity through continuing.
Yeah, that's the lovely thing about it. It sounds like everything's being put in its right place when you hear Bach performing. Does the thing about that kind of music, though, it's kind of perfect. It's like a little bit of beautiful, I don't know, clockwork's not quite the right word for it. It's fantastic. But it seems to deny a whole other aspect of human life, doesn't it? The romantic, the passionate,
yeah.
and madness. There's no madness in Bach.
That's a really good point. There's a lot of things in there. There's a lot of humanity in there, I feel. And of its time, it is intensely human. It's sort of very spiritual, but very human at the moment. But you're right, it's never unhinged. Does a type of music have to be everything, though, in order to be legitimate?
No.
And as you say, it can be like clockwork, and it can be sort of this, especially the preludes and fugues, for instance, this tremendous mathematical achievement of everything being in its right place. But also some of those fugues can be deeply emotional.
Can you hear kindness there?
I feel I can. A sort of, maybe not a specific interpersonal kindness, but a sort of benevolence, a sort of humanistic benevolence. I feel I can hear that.
What did Mrs. Sivan as a teacher think she could do for you? What did she think her role was as a teacher to give to you or bring out in you? How did she talk about that?
Oh, she has huge ambitions in her teaching. And they're not just about creating pianists. They're about, I suppose, awakening some sort of inner artist. And the process of trying to awaken an artist, I think, is also about really developing human potential. And, I mean, her teaching is also underpinned by all these kind of moral aspirations of really encouraging her students to be generous, teaching them they have to be grateful, making sure that they stay humble.
Right. Keeping the ego down to manageable size. So for what?
Yeah. Well, that's the challenge, isn't it? Because I think you have to have a fairly robust ego in order to stand up on stage in the first place. But she, you know, she'd hated if someone seemed to be getting too big for their boots and felt they were... Well, there's a particular type of, I think, playing that you sometimes come across in which actually the composer's message can be effaced by the performer trying to sort of impose their personality on it too much. And I think our job as interpreters is actually to try to realise somebody else's message and make it our own, absolutely, and bring everything that we have as human beings to it.
Were you able to pick all this up as a 9-year-old?
No.
All these lessons?
No.
So
no,
what
no.
happened when she put all this to you? What would you do hearing all this?
Well,
stuff?
I was very dutiful and very polite and very well behaved, and I'd just sort of sit there and nod.
And then how long did it take before her lessons started to sink in?
Well, I think we had a few crisis points. We had one crisis point in which she claimed I'd never be a concert pianist because I was too... I think because I was so reserved, she took that actually to mean I was emotionally cold. And because she didn't recognise me from these very sort of extroverted people who'd surrounded her in Leningrad growing up, I think there was a certain type of Anglo-Saxon reticence there too that was unfamiliar to her. She thought I'd never have enough kind of artistic temperament to be a performer. So she made that, she claimed that I'd never be a concert pianist pretty early in the piece.
Did that hurt?
Oh, it did. And it wasn't even that I really wanted to be a concert pianist at that stage. It was just that when you're a child, you know, you kind of believe you can do anything if you set your mind to it. That's the myth that we're fed.
Was she the first person ever to pull you up short? Because I'm conscious of reading this, you're a really shy and sensitive little girl.
Yeah.
But you've got this great, loving, supportive family.
Oh, yeah.
Who are encouraging you all the time and being fantastic. Mm. Was she the first person who really ever pull you up short and say, you're not going to be a concert pianist?
I think that's part of the show. Maybe that's the reason I decided to try to be one, because it was the first time someone had really properly said no to me about a path. I mean, my parents had quietly discouraged my singing aspirations. But not quite as brutally as that. So it certainly was the hardest thing for me in my childhood was music, and I think perhaps that's what made it so compelling.
She said that she used to say, "What's the difference between good and a great pianist?" And the answer was always little bits. What does she mean by that?
Well, I didn't understand that either at first, but now I think I do, and it's about that kind of critical detail that separates the good from the great in any form of human endeavour. It's about the detail, I suppose, even if you were buying like a luxury handbag from Hermes, that's going to separate that from some factory-produced item elsewhere. They're both handbags, they both have the same function, but every single little detail is going to be better. It's not the nicest analogy because it makes great art sound like a luxury good, which I don't think it is. But it's just a little bit more understanding, I should say. It's a little bit more hearing. It's a little bit more artistic freedom, it's a little bit more discipline, it's a little bit of this and a little bit of that. And
the great accumulation of details.
The accumulation of details, exactly.
That makes a richer kind of thing at the end of the process.
Yeah.
Your dad took you to every lesson and sat there very patiently while you were being taught.
Well, he had an agenda.
Did he? Now, what was your dad's secret agenda?
His secret agenda. Actually, I shouldn't say that, because I think first he took me there just out of interest, really, and support. But then he too was really taken by this figure of such passion and culture in our lives that he started jotting down notes that eventually took the form of a novel. And that novel was his, I suppose, breakthrough novel, Maestro, which was published in about 1989, I think. And I remember when he first showed me the sketches of this book, in which he was using some of Eleanor, Mrs. Sivan's dialogue, but sort of warping it so that the character who was speaking these words was no longer this warm, effusive Russian teacher, but this really misanthropic, alcoholic Viennese character called Eduard Keller. And I thought she'd be horrified. But eventually he came clean and showed her the manuscript, and, you know, it was a good book, and she was happy, and I think on some level honoured by it.
Tell me about your first to Stedford, your first big competition. How did that go?
Well, I was astonished to discover this phenomenon called child prodigy. I think in my little personal universe I'd imagined I was a bit of a child prodigy, but then I turned up and there were these kids who were my age, I suppose 10 or so, and they were doing grade 8 piano. And I was really kind of overwhelmed and awed by them. And I sort of remember thinking, why can't I be one of those? You know, why can't my parents push me more to practice?
What happened with those, with child prodigies in your experience, by and large? Do they stick at it or do they burn out?
I'd say half and half, actually. It's a really interesting issue. I've just read this book. I finished it on the weekend, called Battle Hymn of the Tiger Mother. Have you come across this?
Yes, yes.
Yeah. And I read it with a great deal of ambivalence and confusion. Because her contention, this Chinese parent, is that Chinese parenting is about fostering a child's innate abilities, and it just demonstrates an enormous faith in the child. And to sit by a child and demand that they practice for 6 hours per night actually equips them with really good skills later in life. Well, I didn't get that from my parents. I think perhaps I got a version of that from Mrs. Sivan. Of the two child prodigies who really stuck in my mind from those early competitions, one of them, I think, stopped essentially and became a lawyer. The other one rebelled terribly against his mother, but then came back to piano and is now one of my colleagues.
We were just talking before about your teacher and how she took the view that because you were... She sort of mistook you in a way, didn't she? She mistook your shyness for coolness.
That's exactly... Well, that's what she claims. Now she says, this girl taught me best lesson. And, you know, finally she said, you proved that, you could be a concert pianist.
What was that lesson, though, about shy people, I wonder?
I suppose it was partly a cultural lesson, not to mistake Australian reserve and reticence, emotional reticence, for a lack of an emotional life. And that's a lesson we both had to learn, actually. I had to learn to become more emotionally expressive, more articulate. I mean, one thing I found very difficult to say was thank you in a really meaningful way, and not just in a sort of, you know, polite, offhand way, as I'd been brought up to do. And she'd read me these beautiful cards that her other students had written her, and I'd sort of think, oh, that's a bit on the nose, it's a bit over the top. But actually, I think it is important to be able to say thank you properly.
I'm glad she realised that. Music is one great place where shy people have always gone to find a way of being in public.
You're quite right, yeah.
Music's full of shy, nerdy people.
Well, all performances, actually, I think. Perhaps because it's a more formal environment, it's easier to, I suppose, sort of function in an extroverted way somehow in that context.
Even in the wildest punk rock groups, you will find nerdy, shy people. There. Yeah. That's the truth of it. It's a way to be kind of graceful in public, I think.
Yeah.
You're a teenage girl learning Shostakovich, and that's really interesting too. You know, Shostakovich's life is just extraordinary. You know, he lived through the siege of Leningrad, where he and other citizens had to practice cannibalism in order to survive. He was tried to exist under the thumb of Stalin. He was terrorized by Stalin from time to time. What did you think about that? What can a little girl know of that? When even a teenage girl know of everything someone like Shostakovich, how can you draw that out of the music? Well, tell me what you think about that, and what did she think about that?
Yeah, I suppose growing up as a privileged child in Adelaide, you don't obviously have a first-hand experience of that sort of horror, but Shostakovich was a figure who haunted our lessons right from the beginning. Mrs. Sivan had known him as a child in Russia. He'd taken her under his wing, and she used to play his children's pieces for other composers. So he was a really seminal figure for her, a great inspiration as a human being and an artist, and she spoke of him constantly from the first time I went to her as a 9-year-old. And in fact, some of the very first pieces I studied with her were his early Dances of the Dolls, his childhood pieces, Dances of the Dolls.
Well, he wrote this as a child, right?
Sorry, I shouldn't have said earlier, he didn't actually write these as a child, he wrote them for children.
For children.
And these are works, and these are works of sort of the most beautiful melodic charm. And one thing Mrs. Sivan used to say to me was that, you know, people would claim Shostakovich couldn't write a melody, but who feels like singing when they've got a jackboot on their chest? Because that's the sort of pressure he lived under. As you said, Stalin played this sort of cat and mouse game with him throughout his life and just enjoyed torturing him. But sometimes you can actually hear these sort of beautiful melodic pieces, and this is an example. Some of his film music is another example.
Oh, The Gadfly, yeah.
The Gadfly, yeah.
I want to play one part of an excerpt from Dances of the Dolls. This is you playing Shostakovich. That is Anna Goldsworthy playing a lovely little excerpt of Shostakovich's Dances of the Dolls, I should say. Just trying to get that right there. Anna is my guest in conversation as well. Now, far from, you just looked and, you know, just check that out there, that far from that being one of his earlier pieces, that was one of the very last, well, towards the end of his career he wrote that, around about the same time Stalin died.
1953 he wrote that.
Yeah. I wonder what that's about, that trying to find melody and a sense of hope again around about the time when Stalin's departing the scene.
It must have been a tremendous relief, you can only imagine.
How did your attitude to practicing evolve over time as you studied under this extraordinary Russian woman?
Well, yes, with my very first teacher, I remember him saying I had to practice for 5 hours a day, and I thought that was unbearable. Every single day to have
it
to
is
practice
unbearable,
for five whole minutes.
How can anyone do that?
I don't know. It's astonishing. And, you know, my parents said, well, you clean your teeth every day. And I thought, yeah, but even that's a bit of a strain. And then I went to Eleonora, Mrs. Hivan, at the age of 9, and she made this announcement that she expected me to be practicing about 2 hours a day, which was just seemed epic and was well beyond my 9-year-old capacity for self-discipline. So I didn't practice that much as a 9-year-old. But then a little bit later on, I think in retrospect this was quite a turning point, she got a new student called Kate Stevens, who was 3 years older than me, and was making the most astonishing progress and was actually quite passionate about practicing. And I was just awed by what Kate could do at the piano. And I think probably that's when I sort of realigned myself a bit and started thinking, well, maybe the grown-ups are right and maybe practice does make perfect. Like, as a child, you have no experience of that. You just have to take it on faith. Because you don't really see minute by minute. You don't get a great sense of progress minute by minute while you're practicing. It's more sort of cumulative. So then I reckon I got a bit more serious at about the age of 15, and that's when things started turning around for me.
One thing I've realised from your book is that when you talk to classical pianists, they might be very nice to you, but really they're counting the seconds until they can get back to practicing again, aren't they?
Well, yes.
Yes.
They do tend to, less so now for me, but certainly for years you have to. I mean, to really get a proper day's practice in, especially when you're a student and you're having to learn all your repertoire, a proper day's practice would usually be 5 or 6 hours of practice. And that doesn't sound like that much. You think, well, why don't you just get up at 7 in the morning, get it all done by lunchtime, and then you can do whatever you like in the afternoon. But you can't actually just sit down and do that in a row. You have to take practice breaks. I used to find that I could maybe do one thing per day apart from practice if I really wanted to fit it all in.
How did that change for you? Was there a moment when you became addicted to practicing? Like,
yeah.
Like physically longed for practice?
Yeah, I think so. I think it was part of my sort of sanctuary in adolescence was getting to the piano. It was an environment that I could control when everything else seemed to be a bit beyond my control and a bit confusing. So there was that aspect to it. There is also the addictive pleasure there's the tactile pleasure of playing an instrument, which you'd be aware of. And then beyond that, there's the addictive pleasure of just sensing your own improvement. And the more you practice, the more you invest in it, the more sort of exponential your improvement becomes. And that is actually quite exhilarating.
What did Mrs. Sivan say about Chopin? What was his secret? What did she have to say about him?
Oh, he has a few secrets, but one of his biggest secrets was that he actually fell in love with the piano for its own sake. A lot of the great composers who came before Chopin, like Bach and Mozart and Beethoven, you know, they loved music and, well, in Bach's case, he didn't know the piano, but in Mozart's case, sure, he loves the piano, but he sort of looks through the piano to create opera. Most of his piano sonatas are sort of operas, mini operas on the piano. Or Beethoven, when he creates for the piano, he's sort of writing symphonies for the piano. Whereas Chopin actually falls in love with the instrument for its own sake. He falls in love with its sound, he falls in love with its sonorities, but he also actually kind of physically falls in love with the instrument. And playing Chopin is a great tactile pleasure. It is a great physical pleasure. And her sort of physical approach to playing Chopin would be one of, you know, just absolutely melting your hands down. There's nothing between yourself and the piano. You're kind of embracing the instrument. There's a beautiful line that Chopin writes in one of his letters to one of his friends in which he says, now you're not here with me, I have to tell the piano all of my secrets. And there's absolutely this aspect, I think, to Chopin's music. It's confessional, it's intimate, it's really intimate. It's very, very beautiful to play because of that.
How tactile was Mrs. Sivan towards a shy, slightly restrained? Would she actually hold your hands?
Oh, yes,
and touch
extremely
hands?
Tactile. Very physical process of imparting pianistic technique. And I think that's, because now I try to work it out with my own students. How was it that she was actually able to get inside my hands and teach me how to be so relaxed at the instrument? And I think a lot of it was that kind of moulding my hands, grabbing my hands, holding my hands while I played. I think it actually is a direct sort of physical transference.
I want to play another piece of you playing here from the album of piano lessons. This is a Chopin etude in G flat major. It's called the black key, obviously, because that's a nasty key, that one. It's all black keys, isn't it?
It's all right hands, all black keys. Amazing right. What he can do with that.
Here it is. Goldsworthy showing her extraordinary typing speed there with that beautiful Chopin etude there. That is the Chopin etude in G-flat major, Opus 10, number 5, black key. That's just lovely, isn't it? It's like, I don't know, I have my own pictures in there, but do you tell me what pictures are in your head when you play something as lovely as that, Anna?
Well, that particular piece, I think, as you say, it's lovely. It's, I mean, Chopin's etudes, which are essentially studies for the piano, are actually not just technical studies, but each piece is this wonderful work of music. And some of them are dramatic and works of protest, but this one is just a celebration of life.
It's like opening a bottle of champagne.
You're right, bubbles.
That's what it is.
It sparkles everywhere. Bubbles.
And it's fizzing over the edge of the bottle. It's just joyous and fun. That's lovely. Anna Goldsworthy is with me at the moment. Her memoir, Piano Lessons, is also a CD and a stage production as part of the Queensland Music Festival. So your piano playing developed by leaps and bounds. You're practicing for enormous hours. You won these prizes, the Tennyson Prize, the Don Maynard Prize, and that's when you got your first lesson in media management, didn't you?
Oh, I did,
What went horribly wrong there?
after my Year 12 success, I was called into the Adelaide Advertiser for an interview, and, you know, I told them... what did I tell them? I told them I was going to be a concert pianist without really knowing what that meant at that stage. And they said, oh, do you have to move somewhere else to do that? And I said, oh, I don't know, maybe Sydney. And
nearest big smoke you could think of, right?
Yeah. Centre of the universe. Yeah. And, you know, very ambitious. And then I said, I mentioned that my kindergarten teacher had taught me how to read. And I mentioned Mrs. Sivan in passing, but I didn't thank my family. And then the following day, the article came out and it said something like, Anna plans to move to Sydney to seek fame and fortune as a concert pianist. She attributes all of her success to her kindergarten teacher who taught her how to read. So you can imagine how thrilled Mrs. Sivan was to read that in the newspaper.
What happened when you spoke to her on the phone? How did she sound?
She sounded quite cold and said, I hear you're going to Sydney. And of course you must go to Sydney. I won't stop you. And then I thought, oh dear, this is really dire. It's more serious than I realised. And I got Dad to drive me over to her house. And on the way there, I think that was actually when the penny dropped to me about how much she had given me. Because...
what, you hadn't realised?
Not really. As a child, you kind of take it all for granted. I at least I did. Maybe I was a particularly narcissistic child. But, you know, that was her job. She was supposed to be my piano teacher. But what I probably hadn't sort of accounted for... the huge number of hours she poured into my education that were uncharged. You know, my lessons by this stage would go for 2 or 3 hours, possibly twice a week. The amount of care, the amount of love, the amount of passion that went into those lessons, and also the fact that this was the place that she was enacting her art, was in these lessons. She wasn't performing around the world. She was a concert pianist in Russia, but now her entire art and her entire genius, and it's a significant genius, I mean, she's a truly astonishing musician, was just being poured into these sort of little vessels of her students. And then one of them would tell the newspaper that they attribute all their success to their kindergarten teacher and they're moving to Sydney. That would have been tremendously hurtful for her. And again, I wouldn't even have conceived of that because I don't think I really viewed her as a human being, you know, like me, subject to ups and downs and even capable of being hurt by me. And so that was, again, a turning point in our relationship in that I realised she was a little bit vulnerable. And also how much I did owe her.
Meanwhile, you were quite a, you know, you were essentially Lisa Simpson of Adelaide at that point.
You're right.
You
played the piano, not the saxophone. But
yes, played piano, not the saxophone. But you're also on top of the school or the state in like things like maths and English as well. Were you doing that in English as well? Like these extraordinary high marks right across the board there. Were you having to did you feel like the need to impersonate being a normal girl in those days?
I think by the time I finished school, I'd sort of done with that impersonation. But absolutely, throughout my teenage years, I did sort of flirt with normality.
How'd you
unsuccessfully.
Go? Unsuccessfully? Did you start to feel nonetheless, though, at the end of your high school years, life starting to tug you away from the monastery of the piano?
That's kind of a conflict that probably informs your whole life as an artist, is sometimes I'd see what my friends could do who weren't practicing 6 hours a day, and I'd long to be there. And then at other times I'd take time away from this great discipline, and then I'd sort of think, well, maybe this isn't so great without having this passion in my life after all.
You formed you studied all over the world, and you formed the Seraphim Trio, chamber music trio, which is still going now. 17 years or something it's been going?
It has, yeah, 17, you're right.
What happened when you went to Mrs. Sivan for advice on chamber music? What advice did she have for you?
Well, the first time I took my trio to see her, I was terrified, actually. I mean, first of all, I was embarrassed that my trio would see me in this position of sort of disciple and supplicant, And secondly, it was desperately important to me that she'd approve of them and think we were a good trio. And we sat down to play. We played Shostakovich, actually, the great piano trio by Shostakovich. And which is a very painful work, much more painful than that Dance of the Dolls that we played before. And we got to the end of the first movement of that, and she said, oh, you know, it's great, fantastic, you play very nicely. Only one person you forgot to invite to this party, it's Shostakovich. You missed his intellectualism, you missed his suffering, you missed this, you missed that, you missed a million things. And my two friends were just silenced by this. But she kind of got the message across, first of all, of the subtext of that work. But beyond that, a message about chamber music generally, which is about really listening and really truly listening, not just sort of pretending to listen, but actually listening to your colleagues more even than you listen to yourself. And that's the way you're able to achieve this, sometimes this result that's so much greater than the sum of its parts.
You're in a band. I mean,
yeah. Same deal.
Same
yeah.
thing. There's a kind of weird intimacy that happens in a band too, isn't there?
An astonishing intimacy. These guys are my siblings. We got a new cellist 11 years ago, Tim, when our first cellist, Leah, left us. But we've been through all the sort of major ups and downs together as a group. We've found our partners, we've started having children, we've suffered, well, Helen and Tim have both lost people very close to them. We've been in a high-speed car accident together, you know, we've just done so much together. And
How did you get into a high-speed car accident? And what did that mean for your playing?
That was 3.5 years ago in Germany, and somebody was driving us, a lovely host there was driving us home from a mountain trip, and I was asleep in the back seat, and we just had this horrible high-speed car accident, front-on collision. Happily, we were all fine. I mean, I fractured my back and sprained a few ribs, and it took me a while to heal. And the others were not as badly injured as I was. But it was, you know, it was traumatic. These kind of accidents always are quite traumatic. But, you know, being sort of...
A fractured back is no minor thing.
No, it's not. It took a while for it to be diagnosed, and because I didn't realise it was fractured, I sort of just played through it. And, you know, we had concerts, and I just kept on doing those. Which is maybe one of those instances where that kind of self-discipline has gone a little bit too far. But you don't want to let the team down either, do you?
No. I think it's interesting you're decidedly a writer as well. I think you're quite emphatic about that. I'm a classical pianist and a writer. Tell me about that, how the writing came into your life. I mean, it was always there with your dad, wasn't it?
The writing's always been there since I was a child, and I think perhaps I had... I think it came more naturally to me even as a child, the writing. And then I met this tremendous person who sort of steered the whole ship around and turned me into a musician. When I was 21, I moved to Texas to do a master's degree, and the experience was bewildering, very, very hard to make sense of. Just so many worlds away from the Adelaide that I grew up in that I actually sort of turned to writing just to kind of feel at home and just to make sense of it. And I started writing a monthly column for an Adelaide newspaper, the Adelaide Review, which rarely mentioned music but was about the kind of extremes of Texan culture, you know, cowboys and Mary Kay ladies and tornadoes and all those kind of really surreal aspects of Texan life. So I did that and I really enjoyed it.
Does it come from the same place as the music comes from? Does it live there, or is it a whole other compartment that you've opened up in your life?
I suspect they're similar, and I've been thinking this lately. Every night I read my two-year-old son songs, read him books, and I sing him nursery rhymes. And the way he responds to the two, I kind of sense that they belong to the same family.
I think so too.
You think so too. On the other hand, when I'm on stage performing, I often incorporate aspects of the sort of spoken word, and there definitely is a gear change going from one to the other. There definitely is a gear, and I'm finding that transition easier now than I used to, but it can be challenging.
What sort of relationship do you have with silence when you're not hearing anything for long periods of time? Has there been a moment when you've been exposed to protracted isolation from music?
Yeah, a couple of moments. I was actually at a writer's retreat earlier this year at the Varuna Writer's House in the Blue Mountains in New South Wales, and I wasn't practicing and I wasn't teaching and I didn't have music going through my head all day. And after a day or two, I just noticed my head became so noisy. Just all this music that I wanted to hear, that I wasn't playing. But several years ago, I was in the middle of a concert tour. I spent a couple of days on the Aran Islands off the coast of Galway in Ireland with my partner, and that's a tremendously silent place. It's maybe one of the quietest places in the world.
The sky goes on forever there too.
It does.
As you look out to the Atlantic.
Doesn't it? And I really actually kind of had this physical response in which I could hear noises in my ears. Sort of strange to describe. But it almost felt like all the noises of my body, all the noises of this kind of tour were sort of coming out.
Not music, noises.
Kind of quasi-musical noises, a combination of both. Gongs and
gongs?
Trumpets. Yes, it was very peculiar.
You're in the Aran Islands and you're getting gongs
yes,
and trumpets in your
not
ear.
What you're supposed to hear. You're supposed to hear sort of cowbells, aren't you? So I think, I don't know, after a day of practice and teaching and rehearsing, I come home and I sometimes don't feel inclined to put on a CD and listen to more music. I actually crave a bit of silence. And, you know, Mozart used to say silence is the purest form of music. But obviously if there's too much silence, then there's a musical impulse that demands to be expressed.
You've written the book Piano Lessons, which is largely about your relationship with Mrs. Sivan, your teacher. What did she think of the book when it was released? Did she like herself in the book? Did she recognise herself in the book?
I was terrified of her reception, truly phobic, to the point of almost wanting to cancel the book. My poor publisher had to be my counsellor through that process.
When did you tell her? Did you tell her at the outset you were writing a book about her?
Yeah, I did. I did. And so then there was the whole issue of her expectations. But then one weekend I threw it in the post, went on holiday with my family. Not a particularly pleasurable holiday. I was too angst-ridden. Came home and called her. And she was so lovely. She said she got up to the penultimate chapter of the book, which is a chapter in which she's in hospital and unconscious and in sort of dire, in a dire medical condition. And she said she got to that chapter and she was reading it. And she felt so sorry for me, for the narrator, who was obviously going through this grief response, that she actually started crying, feeling my poor, poor Anna. She was suffering so much, forgetting that it was her who was sort of at death's door. And so I took that as a lovely tribute. She was so sort of caught up in the story that she forgot that it was about herself. And to me, that was just the most tremendous compliment.
And now it's going to be a stage production. It's part of the Queensland Music Festival. That's going to be weird. You're going to be on stage. What, narrating or being yourself?
Both.
Really?
Yes.
That's going to be weird. And there'll be a little girl being the young...
No. I'm narrating it, and occasionally I sort of step back in the course of storytelling into my child self. But I can't stay there very long because it's just a bit absurd. But I've got this tremendous actor, Caroline Kennison, playing the part of Mrs. Sivan, which makes the whole thing a whole lot easier. But it is. It's a particularly sort of strange form of therapy, acting your childhood memoir, reliving these scenes of conflict and triumph and disappointment and failure.
We should all get that opportunity, I think.
Yeah, possibly.
We don't always have a Mrs. Sivan in our lives, though, no. Sadly. You're so lucky. It's great to have you in today, Anna. Thank you so much for being my guest in conversation.
Thanks for having me.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more information and interviews, visit abc.net.au/conversations.